All right, my name is Louis Lusardi. I'm director of the Educational Communications Center, and I've had other positions at Stony Brook. I've been in this position since January 1980. I came to Stony Brook originally as a consultant in 1966, working with Carl. And then at that time I was 41 years of age. And in 1968 I came on full-time, working jointly for the Research Foundation and the Stony Brook Foundation. I came here working for a company in New York. I'd only been there a few months. Previously I'd been at Lincoln Center, and before that at Wesleyan. Carl was responsible for my coming. I was interviewed by John Toll, Carl Hartzell, and the Stony Brook Council, including Ward Melville. Why did I come? I came because I felt that Stony Brook was a young and growing institution. I'd had a lot of experience on other college campuses. I'd visited or stayed at something like 40 campuses in the previous years. And I felt there was a place, there was something important to be done here. The factors that were most important was the size of Stony Brook. It was so new, but everything lay ahead of it. And I was subject matter like media and the arts, which were not even fully formed at that time, were of great interest to me. I had a lot of experience in both areas. I've been at CBS as a writer, and I've done a lot of work at Lincoln Center and other places as director of the Lincoln Center Fund. My understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook, of course, I had some knowledge of the Heald Commission, but it seemed to me that when it was fully grown, Stony Brook would probably be the most influential institution of higher education on Long Island, Nassau and Suffolk combined. State University had no pathfinder institution on Long Island, and it was obvious that Stony Brook was going to be that. What was the vision being transformed into reality? I'm not sure that all of the vision has been transformed into reality. I think much of it has. But I think with the amount of growth that I've seen, that there have been incredible problems that linger. Growth creates its own set of problems. When I came to Stony Brook, my impressions were that it was very much like a small liberal arts college. I think the total number of students was something like 2,000 students. The budget was less than $15 or $20 million. But there were things going on. The ESS building was being built. Physics was obviously very strong. There were graduate programs. There were some things that surprised me looking back. For example, the Stony Brook Union had not been built. First day I ever stepped on campus with Carl. The library, which was then the very small library, it was homecoming. And there was a big Ferris wheel outside the library, and there were people on the Ferris wheel. The girls wore skirts. The men wore shirts and ties, and it reminded me of places like Oberlin and some of the Ivies. Having been at Wesleyan for some years, I could see many similarities. Of course, all that's gone. Campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit, it was very up. Everything was up. Everything was looking toward the future. I can remember going to a meeting of the presidents in the president's conference room and having Bentley Glass saying, well, we should have a continuing education division. And within a month it was here. It was that kind of situation. Couldn't do that today. what events, what persons, what experiences stand out, I'll have to come back to that because there are too many. What was your understanding of your own place in the future of Stony Brook? Why do you think you were appointed?
Well, there were very few traditions of Stony Brook at the time, but one of the traditions of state institutions and land-grant institutions was that regardless of the state budgets, an incredible amount of private money would be needed, and research money. And you look at Texas, or you look at even a place like Oklahoma, or even Virginia, where if you look at the endowment, Carl, why don't you turn that off? Just turn that thing on the top.
Yes, it's taking your cigarette smoke.
Just turn it all the way off. It's making a noise that the machine will pick up. And it was obvious, I think, to Carl and John Toll and other people that the institution had to produce private money, and fundamentally that was my job as director of development at the foundation.
We needed flexible funds.
Yeah.
Outside the budget.
That's right. What expectations did you have when you came? I expected to play an important role, and as things turned out, there were several roles that were played as the years went by. And I think, looking back, my expectations have been realized, most of them. Did I have relations outside the campus? Yes. With the central office in Albany? Yes. At one point, I was appointed the Stony Brook representative for the Region 4 Arts Committee, which was, I would say 15 campuses between here and Sullivan County. And my job was to interface Stony Brook interests, particularly the work of the three arts departments, into a SUNY-wide arts program. Also, I took the initiative some years back in developing something called the Long Island Media Consortium, of which I was chairman. And this was basically an attempt to list all of the non-print materials, non-print, non-computer materials, like videotapes, films, slides, and so on, of all the private and public institutions on Long Island, develop a master list so that people from Hofstra could borrow from Stony Brook, or people from Stony Brook could borrow from Old Westbury. This is now run by the library, has been for some years. That's worked out very well. That kind of cooperative effort was a good step, I think, for Stony Brook. I also have a continuing relationship with other ECC directors across the state. We meet regularly. We have regional committees. We have statewide committees to discuss common problems. And
ECC stands for
Educational Communication Center. It used to be called the Instructional Resource Center.
Ed Lamb was involved initially, wasn't he?
That's right. He was the first director. He was the director until about 1974, 75. Then there was a period when Don Marks, who was the assistant director, took over. And then in 1976, a man named Frank Lyon came to Stony Brook and took over the ECC, and then in 1980 I was appointed. I would say, going back, 20 years, that my primary responsibility at the time was to raise funds for the Stony Brook Foundation.
Now, the Stony Brook Foundation in those days was not looked on by Albany as being something that even should exist.
Right.
And there were continual battles. I think when I was appointed with Boyer as chancellor, and Beth Moore was the chairman of trustees, there was the feeling that foundations across the state were important. And of course, Buffalo's foundation, which had been in existence even when it was private, was kind of the pathfinder in foundations. But we had continuing problems with Albany about the foundation. And in 1971, the new vice president for finance and management, named Joseph Diana, came on this campus and created quite a stir. 1971 was the year when John Toll was given a sabbatical to be in Albany for 6 months, and Alec Pond was the acting president, and Albany was, I think, rightfully dissatisfied with some of the administrative procedures here dealing with money. I remember Alec, I think it must have been in April or May of 1971, telling me that the campus had overspent something like $800,000. And it was up to Joe Diana to come to grips with this and set up new systems and hire new staff. And one of the things that he was given as a charge, apparently, by Albany was to do one of two things about the foundation: either take it over completely or get it out of existence. And there was nothing half-hearted about his attitude.
Who do you think gave him?
Ray Cutler.
Ray who?
Cutler.
Cutler
was the vice chancellor for finance. And, you know, you hear stories. For example, I don't know all of the politics involved, but I remember when Joe Diana's resume landed on the desk of the of John Toll, and we went to a vice president's meeting, and Alex turned to John, and John said, this man has been selected carefully by Ray Cutler, and he has a job to do, and it involves ripping this place apart. And Alex said to John, you're going to have to take him, because if you don't take him, Ray Cutler will come up with someone just like him. And Diana started going through the whole operation with a sharp knife. Some of the things he did were very good. For example, he discovered that Don Ackerman in the Research Foundation had sidetracked about $55,000 of research money into his own pocket. And of course he fired him, brought him up on charges. But he made a lot of false accusations. He accused Juan Randall of stealing $25,000, and that went on for about a year and a half. And an arbitrator appointed by both parties finally decided that it was all a lot of hogwash. He did several things like this. And he appointed people who were very antagonistic. When I left the foundation, one of his associates, who shall be nameless because he's still here, came to me and said that he didn't understand why I had charged a certain lunch on the American Express card. And I told him who I'd taken to lunch, which was already written up. And he said, he made the statement, well, he said, we're going through this with a fine-tooth comb, and anything we find out of order, we'll refer to the district attorney. That was his attitude. And I went to Johnny on that. Didn't get anywhere. But he finally hung himself because he made too many false accusations. And
Diana.
And when he decided to go to, I think to Illinois, he'd come out of Michigan, everybody gave him a glowing reference and off he went. So that was the end of Diana. But he created a tremendous amount of turmoil while he was here and was officious in every way. And he never did, I think, do any lasting damage, although a lot of people resigned or were fired or whatever. But that's, at this point, it's ancient history.
I was in on the origins of the foundation. I was one of the three incorporators.
Right.
And Ward Melville, who had sat in on a meeting of the council at which I recommended that the foundation be set up, and pointed to Buffalo, but also pointed to the endowments of the Big Ten,
yes,
let alone Harvard, Yale, and Princeton.
That's right.
Because the public, big public universities in the Midwest had large endowments of private funds.
Right.
The concept around here was, why should people give to a public institution?
Mm.
And we had to change that. And Ward paid for the paperwork done by his own legal firm, setting up the foundation.
Pelletreau?
No.
Sibley?
No, it's in New York.
Oh, okay. Oh, Milbank Tweed. Milbank Tweed was his company. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, it's Polk somebody.
Davis Polk.
Davis Polk, yeah, that's the... I think that was in either 64 or early 65.
It was early 65, I think.
Early 65, but we had been talking about it before that. And when Sam Gould came in, he was unhappy that we had...
Sam was?
Yes, the foundation, because he was primarily interested in centralizing just about everything he possibly could in Albany.
Yeah.
And,
but I think Beth Moore had a different attitude, because I remember her saying to me when she was ready to step down as chairman of trustees, she said, I really did not want to step down until two things had happened in the state system. And one is that I wanted funding for development offices on every campus and foundations that are accepted wholly by Albany. And the second thing she wanted was a real alumni organization throughout the state. And she felt that when she left, that these two things had been accomplished. So there must have been a schism of feeling, maybe with some of the other trustees, I don't know. I don't know any of the other trustees.
Well, I think the idea that everything could be run from Albany was erroneous. You needed local support,
right,
for institutions. You needed local initiative,
right,
from institutions. And that should be encouraged. And Stony Brook went its own way in that,
yeah,
respect.
Yeah.
And I think it's been proved to be the correct way to go.
Well, the foundation today is so much a part of the campus that it's, you know, but it is wholly run by state employees, which I frankly do not approve of. I remember Larson, Bill Larson was a trustee, the director of the foundation or whatever, and we went to a foundation meeting. I think you were there.
I was the first secretary.
And he said that he wanted a study made by the executive director of the composition of the directors of the foundation, the way it should be. And I went into a lot of detail, looking at things like conflict of interest and so on, legally. I discovered, incidentally, that later on, that Joe Diana's position on the foundation and his position with the state was, in fact, a conflict of interest. I got a legal opinion on that, but that's something else. Anyway, Johnny said, well, you're on your own on this. And I went ahead and did a study and presented it to Johnny and Bill Larson simultaneously. And my recommendation was that the university officers should, of course, be represented, but they should form the minority. And John was incensed at this. He said, well, for example, I wanted to appoint Alec to the board. And he said, I don't feel I can do that at this point. So I feel that you know, you have foundations like Mellon, for example, which to this day will not support public institutions. I mean, it's just ingrained in their outlook that public institutions are supported by taxes and the private institutions are the ones that should have money, should get money. And the only way you can counter that, and it is a feeling among very old money in this country, the Pews and some of the others, the Rockefellers even, at one time, not recently, but in the 50s and 60s. The only way you can counter that is to make a state foundation, university foundation, as independent as you can make it, so that the decisions about proposals and what have you are developed by non-university people, by the community in effect, and not by the university. This is not to say that the foundation people shouldn't be kept fully informed by the university obviously, they have to have input from the university on what's important, what isn't, and what priorities should be given to certain things. But the decision-making has to be independent. Otherwise, an awful lot of money out there, an awful lot of feeling out there about state institutions is going to be dissipated. You know, they're going to have the old feeling that well, it's the university speaking for the university, it's self-interest. And it's not the community saying that the university, for the sake of the community, should have certain things. And and John and I never saw eye to eye. I didn't push it, of course. But we got some good things done with the foundation. There was a $90,000 grant which came from the Ford Foundation in 1969. And Sid Gelber and I, this is my first contact with Sid, we basically ran that, and Sid relied on me to handle all the finances and what have you. And one of the things I brought to him, Bob Nathans, who was then in physics, came to me with this crazy idea about starting a department of policy analysis. And he needed $10,000 to do some studies with Carnegie Mellon and a few other places. And it was a totally unheard of concept. And I persuaded Sidney to fund this. And I was appointed to the Policy Analysis, Center for Policy and Analysis
Urban
Science.
Urban Studies, something like that.
Yeah, Urban Studies, Policy and Urban Studies. And I went on the advisory board of this, so... to this day, when I meet Bob Nathans, who was the first dean of that of Harriman College, that's what it developed into. Bob says if it hadn't been for you, there wouldn't be any Harriman College. You know, so that, you know. We had the regional medical plan, which generated a great deal of money, and I think the various constituents of the regional medical plan, the hospital executives and so on, felt that the foundation was making too much money on this, you know, and Pellegrino went along with it. But we held them up for a 2.5 year period. We were their fiscal agent, and
the foundation was.
And we got that started. Of course, now it's been transformed into other things, but we did some good work at the foundation. Unfortunately, there came a time when Joe Diana decided that he wanted the foundation, he wanted control of the foundation. And he did something that was, to my mind, both illegal and reprehensible. He hired an accounting firm in New York to come in and look at the books and rearrange the books to make it appear that the foundation was bankrupt. And he did this in a very strange way. He did this in a totally illegal way. You remember that the Quarterly Review of Biology came in. The Quarterly Review of Biology had its own subscription list, and it had developed a plus balance of around $40,000 on the credit side of the ledger. His man from the accounting company came in with the weird idea that since there was a credit for $40,000 on that side of the ledger, there should be a debit on the other side of the ledger for $40,000, an accounting trick, if you will. And the only place where you could debit the $40,000 was the general fund. So the general fund at that point had no money, and I was called to a meeting in John's office and told that I had bankrupted the foundation on the basis of this accounting trick. And I, you know, of course, said, this is ridiculous. That's a bit silly. We've been generating money like mad, and now you just, in one stroke of the pen, you wiped it out through this accounting trick, using the Quarterly Review of Biology as the way to do it. So it went from bad to worse, and finally, I had been doing for about a year special work with Sydney in arts. There was no director of the Center for Contemporary Arts and Letters, and I had, Sydney had asked me to do the programming for that. We had many, many, many programs. We had the Stravinsky Festival, when Igor Stravinsky came out, got a Stony Brook Medal. We had the International Choral Festival with prominent people, Lucas Foss, who then was conductor of the
Buffalo.
And we had the Buffalo Symphony down. And we began to develop a whole series, Sid and I, a whole series of programs in poetry. We had a women's week at Stony Brook where poets and novelists came out. So that when I left the foundation, I dropped my salary by about 30%, but I took a part-time job with the Center for Contemporary Arts and Letters, with Sid sponsoring me. And Beth Moore came down one day. She was here to talk about the World Religions Project. And she said, Lou, she said, you've got to get out of here. She said, I have a job for you at the Henry Luce Foundation. And I said, I feel I've been battered and bruised and accused, but I'm going to stick it out. They're not going to force me off this campus. And she said, well, any help I can give you, she said, you know, that job is going to be available for a little while, and if you change your mind, just let me know. And, but I never did.
How did you come to know her?
I came to know her because one of the clients that, I was vice president of a company, a management consulting company, and my My client, one of my clients, was the old Christian colleges of Asia, United Board. And I worked with her from like 1958 through about 1960, very closely with her and young Henry Luce and her nephew, Hank Luce, and, got to know her extremely well and pleased her in certain ways. We needed a lot of specialty writing to be done, brochures and so on. And I did those, and she really liked them. But and she had used my company in other ways, the Institute for International Education, for example. So that I knew Beth very well, extremely well. You know, gone to the what's the women's club in New York? Had lunch with her several times. Cosmos, was it? One of those clubs.
Century. Cosmos is in Washington.
The Cosmos, not the Century. What is the women's club anyway? It's probably not the women's club anymore. But after about 4 or 5 months of working part-time for the Center for Arts and Letters and doing some consulting at places like the Stony Brook Museums and so on, one day a week, which Sydney permitted me to do, they made me the full-time director, the acting director. And then we began to develop some very important programs. I was acting director until from 71 through 76, and then the permanent director from 76 to 1980. So it was 9 years almost. And during that time, there were a number of things that happened on this campus connected with the center that were, I think, rather important. First of all, Selma Warner, who some of her clients, the poets, the Voznesensky, the Russian poet, and so on, we'd used in programs. So I knew Selma rather well. And one day she came to me, and we'd had Senator Yates and Mrs. Yates and Katrina, the daughter here, and Mrs. Yates had given a harp recital and what have you was in the Union Auditorium. And she came up with the idea that the senator needed some money, that his daughter was getting married, Katrina, that she wanted to settle in the United States, and she obviously needed some spending money. And did I have any interest at all in, since she knew that we were in the business of acquiring archives, would we be interested in buying the Yates papers? So I looked into it, discovered that you couldn't buy them because they are one of the national treasures of Ireland. But we could certainly arrange for copies of the materials at a price of $50,000. And I talked to Sydney about this. I went to Albany. I talked to Lonnie Clare in the legal department. I talked to all kinds of people about this. And we finally arranged to pay that at $16,000 odd for 3 years. And the Yates archives, they were split between what was in the Senator's house and what was in the National Library. And the director of the library, when I made contact with him, turned out to be very receptive to this idea.
Who was that then?
That was Pat Henchy.
Pat Henchy, uh-huh.
And we worked all this out with Pat. And there was only one Xerox company in the whole of Dublin, so that we had to use that company. And unfortunately, the stuff in the senator's house was in shoe boxes and in desk drawers and closets and what have you, totally disorganized. If we'd have had the funds and the time, I think we would have hired a Yates scholar to go over there and organize it before it was Xerox, but we didn't. So we took it the way it was. Anyway, 80,000 pages of material finally came by microfilm through U.S. Customs.
We had to pay duty on that, and we retrieved them.
But this was the first time that the Yates materials had been put together in a regular retrieval form. Because if you go into the National Library, you go down into the basement, and they didn't have then, I'm sure don't have now, the funds for things like fire alarm systems or humidity and heat control. And it's just a series of boxes on the shelves, and you can open those boxes, and no one's there to supervise what you're doing, and take down the original manuscripts. And someone like Dave Clark, who's a Yates scholar, very fond of telling me how he got to the airport at Kennedy and opened up his briefcase, and here was a letter from Yates that he mistakenly put into his folder. And he had to ask them if they wanted him to send it, and he went back about 3 months later and returned it to them. But it was chaos, you know. Yates is still, I think, an untapped field. You have scholars in Europe, you have scholars in Canada, you have scholars in Australia, and even in Japan, who are very interested in Yates' works for all kinds of reasons. And
he was a kind of triple threat person.
That's right. Not just the poetry and the plays, but this whole business of mysticism and automatic writing, politics, the Abbey Theater. Yeah. Just goes on and on and on. So Sidney and I went over and made a trip and stayed at the Yates house and came back, and papers were exchanged and the whole thing was set up. Unfortunately, there was an old tag around here that goes something like, what we've done is create instant fame. That if we can acquire something, we can tell the world that we have acquired it and get instant fame, but there's no way in the world that we can find the funds to nurture it. And this is what happened with the Yates archives. The first thing I did was convert the microfilm to, Sidney found some money, and we put it into book form, still without it being organized. And then we hired a young PhD candidate, Ryan Hegday, from the English department, who was having, his dissertation was on Yates, to try somehow to create an index of these 80,000 pages.
Was he the Indian?
Yes. And he worked from 1976, when we acquired these, until 1983, when I gave them up to the library. And he worked for, all I could afford to pay him was $20 a week.
Is that still? Let me look at it for you.
Halfway.
All right. So that it was a slow, laborious job.
And but he did create an index, and the index today is still what's being used in the library. They're putting it on a computer and doing a number of other things with it, but it's his work that has made it possible. We also
remember the festival.
That's right. We had a 2 week long summer festival with the Yates Festival, with everything from plays and music groups. We had all kinds of people, poets from all over the world, and scholars from the University of London, Toronto, all over, people from Australia. And it was a very, very successful festival, and the first of its kind, I might say.
Hence, he stayed with us.
Yeah.
With Anne and me.
I know he did. I saw him at your house a couple of times. But unfortunately, he left, and the new director, his great friends were in Toronto, and the Toronto people were mad as hell that we'd acquired these materials. And they felt that if they'd known they were available, they would have made a better offer. And of course, one of the great difficulties was that Senator Yates did not know anybody at Stony Brook
as well as he knew people at Toronto and other places, because these people were publishing in the field, but no one in Stony Brook was. And even when Tom Flanagan came, I gave Tom an office in the center, but he never used it. He was writing his novels and more interested, I think, in Joyce than he was in Yeats, even though he's a specialist in Irish literature. Then we had a couple of other efforts, the Bartok Archives, which finally, when the center was dissolved in 1983, left with the curator. I mean, we've not been able to give him that much support anyway. We never really held the rights to any of the material, but he made the material available to scholars here at Stony Brook. And then I had a couple of...
Did you take the Bartok Archives with him?
Yeah. Where well, he owned them.
Oh, he owned them.
He owned them.
I see.
We only had the loan of them while they were here.
I see.
I tried for years to... The situation was complicated because Mrs. Bartok was still alive, Mrs. Baylor Bartok. There were two sons, Baylor Jr. and... who's the other son? Peter. And Baylor lived in Hungary, and Peter lived in New York, and they didn't speak to each other. And Peter, who now is the trustee of those archives, since Mrs. Bartok died, is giving them to a university in Switzerland, Basel, I think. And that's what he wanted to do all the time. He bitterly resented the fact that we were even involved in this. Wrote me letters telling me we had no right to do this and no right to do that. Then we had a couple of aborted attempts. And the reason why they were aborted was, I think, because the music department in particular never really understood the role of the Center for Contemporary Arts and Letters. We were not trying to set ourselves up as a separate department, a teaching department. We were an archival repository. If it made more sense to put the archives in the music library, we were perfectly willing to do that. But I made contact with the widow of Edgar Varèse in New York through a friend of mine.
How do you spell it?
V-A-R-E-S-E. Edgar Varèse is the father, the godfather, if you will, of electronic music. Modern music in many ways, and he and Stockhausen are the two giants in the field. There are other people, but these two are the ones that students immediately recognize. And Mrs. Varèse is absolutely, Louise Varèse is an absolutely charming woman. The archival material was in the hands of a man named Wenzhang Chu, CHU, at Columbia University, Dean of the Graduate Music Department, and she introduced me to him, and we talked at great length about bringing the archives to Stony Brook, setting up a separate room, and the archives were voluminous. She actually called me at one point and said that she was moving, and she had Varèse's piano. And would we like to have it? And I said, yes. Well, we still have it on campus. You know, I paid $300 or $400 to move it out here. And it's lying in a basement, I think, in the Fine Arts Center. But what happened was that the music department didn't really want the center to be involved in this kind of activity. And no matter what I did or what Sydney did, they never could understand this. And the unfortunate thing about the Varèse archives was that Boulanger Rell, who's a professor of music in the music department and an electronic music person, had been a student of Varèse's. And there's a very famous piece of Varèse's called America, with a K, which he said when he was a graduate student coming from Turkey. He had worked with Varèse on this, and he, in effect, had done all the work, and Varèse got all the glory. So I went to him and I said, Valent, you know, we have a chance of getting the Varèse archives. And his attitude was that Varese was a non-entity, and that he did not want his materials on campus, that he would fight to the bitter death to prevent his materials from coming on campus.
Strange attitude.
So that was the end of that. Sidney would not fight the music department, and then the chair of the music department contacted Chu.
Who was he?
Sally Fuller. Sarah Fuller. She was at an MLS meeting, and for some reason Chu was there. And she did a job on the center with Chu that she didn't think it was right, that it should come to the music department, and so on and so on and so on. So at that point I threw up my hands and said, well, you know, if the music department really feels that they have the expertise to negotiate this kind of operation, considering that we regard ourselves as the experts, look at Yeats, for example, which was very complicated, go ahead and do it. You know, I washed my hands of the whole thing. And then we had two other things that were killed by the music department. One of them was Beria, who is an Italian modern artist and composer, Lucio Beria. Again, you know, to the average person, it's not very meaningful. But in terms of PhD dissertations, MA work, and so on and so on, any music department would be proud to accept the archives of any of these people, you see. And Beria came here for the International Choral Festival, and I sat down with him, and I said, what are you doing about your material?